Chapter 8. Part 2. I got an answer from Leicester, where the colonel resided, within 2 days. I have it before me as I write, and copy it verbatim. "Dear Bob," it said, "I remember the man well. I was with him at Calcutta, and afterwards at Hyderabad. He was a curious, solitary sort of mortal, but a gallant soldier enough, for he distinguished himself at Sabraon, and was wounded, if I remember right. He was not popular in his corps. They said he was a pitiless, cold-blooded fellow, with no geniality in him. There was a rumor, too, that he was a devil worshipper, or something of that sort, and also that he had the evil eye, which, of course, was all nonsense. He had some strange theories, I remember, about the power of the human will, and the effects of mind upon matter. How are you getting on with your medical studies? Never forget, my boy, that your father's son has every claim upon me, and that if I can serve you in any way, I am always at your command. Ever affectionately yours, Edward Joyce. P.S. By the way, Northcott did not fall in action. He was killed after peace was declared in a crazy attempt to get some of the eternal fire from the Sun Worshipper's temple. There was considerable mystery about his death. I read this epistle over several times, at first with a feeling of satisfaction, and then with one of disappointment. I had come on some curious information, and yet hardly what I wanted. He was an eccentric man, a devil worshipper, and rumored to have the power of the evil eye. I could believe the young lady's eyes, when endowed with that cold, gray shimmer which I had noticed in them once or twice, to be capable of any evil which human eye ever wrought, but still the superstition was an effete one. Was there not more meaning in that sentence which followed? He had theories of the power of the human will, and of the effect of mind upon matter? I remember having once read a quaint treatise, which I had imagined to be mere charlatanism at the time, of the power of certain human minds, and of effects produced by them at a distance. Was Miss Northcott endowed with some exceptional power of the sort? The idea grew upon me, and very shortly I had evidence which convinced me of the truth of the supposition. It happened that at the very time, when my mind was dwelling upon this subject, I saw a notice in the paper that our town was to be visited by Dr. Messenger, the well-known medium and mesmerist. Messenger was a man whose performance, such as it was, had been again and again pronounced to be genuine by competent judges. He was far above trickery, and had the reputation of being the soundest living authority upon the strange pseudosciences of animal magnetism and electrobiology. Determined, therefore, to see what the human will could do, even against all the disadvantages of glaring footlights and a public platform, I took a ticket for the first night of the performance, and went with several student friends. We had secured one of the side boxes, and did not arrive until after the performance had begun. I had hardly taken my seat, before I recognized Barrington Coles, with his fiancée and old Mrs. Merton, sitting in the third or fourth row of the stalls. They caught sight of me at almost the same moment, and we bowed to each other. The first portion of the lecture was somewhat commonplace, the lecturer giving tricks of pure legerdemain, with one or two manifestations of mesmerism, performed upon a subject whom he had brought with him. He gave us an exhibition of clairvoyance too, throwing his subject into a trance, and then demanding particulars, as to the movements of absent friends, and the whereabouts of hidden objects, all of which appeared to be answered satisfactorily. I had seen all this before, however. What I wanted to see now was the effect of the lecturer's will, when exerted upon some independent member of the audience. He came round to that as the concluding exhibition in his performance. "Have shown you," he said, "that a mesmerized subject is entirely dominated by the will of the mesmerizer. He loses all power of volition, and his very thoughts are such as are suggested to him by the master mind. The same end may be attained without any preliminary process. A strong will can, simply by virtue of its strength, take possession of a weaker one, even at a distance, and can regulate the impulses and the actions of the owner of it. If there was one man in the world who had a very much more highly developed will than any of the rest of the human family, there is no reason why he should not be able to rule over them all, and to reduce his fellow creatures to the condition of automatons. Happily, there is such a dead level of mental power, or rather of mental weakness, among us that such a catastrophe is not likely to occur. But still, within our small compass, there are variations which produce surprising effects. I shall now single out one of the audience, and endeavor by the mere power of will, to compel him to come upon the platform, and do and say what I wish. Let me assure you, that there is no collusion, and that the subject whom I may select, is at perfect liberty to resent to the uttermost any impulse which I may communicate to him. With these words the lecturer came to the front of the platform, and glanced over the first few rows of the stalls. No doubt Cole's dark skin and bright eyes marked him out as a man of a highly nervous temperament, for the mesmerist picked him out in a moment, and fixed his eyes upon him. I saw my friend give a start of surprise, and then settle down in his chair, as if to express his determination not to yield to the influence of the operator. Messenger was not a man whose head denoted any great brain power, but his gaze was singularly intense and penetrating. Under the influence of it, Coles made one, or two spasmodic motions of his hands, as if to grasp the sides of his seat, and then half rose, but only to sink down again, though with an evident effort. I was watching the scene with intense interest, when I happened to catch a glimpse of Miss Northcott's face. She was sitting with her eyes fixed intently upon the mesmerist, and with such an expression of concentrated power upon her features as I have never seen on any other human countenance. Her jaw was firmly set, her lips compressed, and her face as hard as if it were a beautiful sculpture cut out of the whitest marble. Her eyebrows were drawn down, however, and from beneath them her gray eyes seemed to sparkle and gleam with a cold light. I looked at Coles again, expecting every moment to see him rise and obey the mesmerist's wishes, when there came from the platform a short, gasping cry as of a man utterly worn out and prostrated by a prolonged struggle. Messenger was leaning against the table, his hand to his forehead, and the perspiration pouring down his face. "I won't go on," he cried, addressing the audience. "Here is a stronger will than mine acting against me. You must excuse me for tonight." The man was evidently ill, and utterly unable to proceed, so the curtain was lowered, and the audience dispersed, with many comments upon the lecturer's sudden indisposition. I waited outside the hall until my friend and the ladies came out. Coles was laughing over his recent experience. "He didn't succeed with me, Bob," he cried triumphantly, as he shook my hand. "Think he caught a tartar that time." "Yes," said Miss Northcott, "I think that Jack ought to be very proud of his strength of mind. Don't you, Mr. Armitage?" "It took me all my time, though," my friend said seriously. "Who can't conceive what a strange feeling I had once or twice? All the strength seemed to have gone out of me, especially just before he collapsed himself. I walked round with Coles in order to see the ladies home. He walked in front with Mrs. Merton, and I found myself behind with the young lady. For a minute or so I walked beside her without making any remark, and then I suddenly blurted out, in a manner which must have seemed somewhat brusque to her, 'You did that, Miss Northcott.' 'Did what?' she asked sharply. 'Why, mesmerized the mesmerizer. I suppose that is the best way of describing the transaction.' 'What a strange idea,' she said, laughing. 'Who give me credit for a strong will then?' 'Yes,' I said. 'Or a dangerously strong one.' 'Why dangerous?' she asked, in a tone of surprise. 'I think,' I answered, 'that any will which can exercise such power is dangerous, for there is always a chance of its being turned to bad uses.' 'You would make me out a very dreadful individual, Mr. Armitage,' she said. And then looking up suddenly in my face, 'You have never liked me. You are suspicious of me and distrust me, though I have never given you cause.' The accusation was so sudden, and so true, that I was unable to find any reply to it. She paused for a moment, and then said in a voice which was hard and cold, Don't let your prejudice lead you to interfere with me, however, or say anything to your friend, Mr. Coles, which might lead to a difference between us. You would find that to be very bad policy. There was something in the way she spoke which gave an indescribable air of a threat to these few words. I have no power, I said, to interfere with your plans for the future. I cannot help, however, from what I have seen and heard, having fears for my friend. Fears, she repeated scornfully. Ray, what have you seen and heard? Something from Mr. Reeves, perhaps. I believe he is another of your friends. He never mentioned your name to me, I answered, truthfully enough. Who will be sorry to hear that he is dying? As I said it, we passed by a lighted window, and I glanced down to see what effect my words had upon her. She was laughing, there was no doubt of it. She was laughing quietly to herself. I could see merriment in every feature of her face. I feared and mistrusted the woman from that moment more than ever. We said little more that night. When we parted, she gave me a quick, warning glance, as if to remind me of what S.E. had said about the danger of interference. Her cautions would have made little difference to me could I have seen my way to benefiting Barrington Coles by anything which I might say. But what could I say? I might say that her former suitors had been unfortunate. I might say that I believed her to be a cruel-hearted woman. I might say that I considered her to possess wonderful and almost preternatural powers. What impression would any of these accusations make upon an ardent lover, a man with my friend's enthusiastic temperament? I felt that it would be useless to advance them, so I was silent. And now I come to the beginning of the end. Hitherto much has been surmise, and inference and hearsay. It is my painful task to relate now, as dispassionately and as accurately as I can, what actually occurred under my own notice, and to reduce to writing the events which preceded the death of my friend. Towards the end of the winter, Coles remarked to me that he intended to marry Miss Northcott as soon as possible, probably sometime in the spring. He was, as I have already remarked, fairly well off, and the young lady had some money of her own, so that there was no pecuniary reason for a long engagement. We are going to take a little house out at Kirstorfen, he said, and we hope to see your face at our table, Bob, as often as you can possibly come. I thanked him, and tried to shake off my apprehensions, and persuade myself that all would yet be well. It was about 3 weeks before the time fixed for the marriage that Coles remarked to me one evening that he feared he would be late that night. Have had a note from Kate, he said, asking me to call about 11 o'clock tonight, which seems rather a late hour, but perhaps she wants to talk over something quietly after old Mrs. Merton retires. It was not until after my friend's departure that I suddenly recollected the mysterious interview which I had been told of as preceding the suicide of young Prescott. Then I thought of the ravings of poor Reeves, rendered more tragic by the fact that I had heard that very day of his death. What was the meaning of it all? Had this woman some baleful secret to disclose which must be known before her marriage? Was it some reason which forbade her to marry? Or was it some reason which forbade others to marry her? I felt so uneasy that I would have followed Coles, even at the risk of offending him, and endeavored to dissuade him from keeping his appointment, but a glance at the clock showed me that I was too late. I was determined to wait up for his return, so I piled some coals upon the fire and took down a novel from the shelf. My thoughts proved more interesting than the book, however, and I threw it on one side. An indefinable feeling of anxiety and depression weighed upon me. 12 o'clock came, and then half past, without any sign of my friend. It was nearly one, when I heard a step in the street outside, and then a knocking at the door. I was surprised, as I knew that my friend always carried a key. However, I hurried down, and undid the latch. As the door flew open, I knew in a moment that my worst apprehensions had been fulfilled. Barrington Coles was leaning against the railings outside with his face sunk upon his breast, and his whole attitude expressive of the most intense despondency. As he passed in, he gave a stagger, and would have fallen had I not thrown my left arm around him. Supporting him with this, and holding the lamp in my other hand, I led him slowly upstairs into our sitting room, He sank down upon the sofa without a word. Now that I could get a good view of him, I was horrified to see the change which had come over him. His face was deadly pale, and his very lips were bloodless. His cheeks and forehead were clammy, his eyes glazed, and his whole expression altered. He looked like a man who had gone through some terrible ordeal, and was thoroughly unnerved. "My dear fellow, what is the matter?" I asked, breaking the silence. "Owing amiss, I trust? Are you unwell?" "Brandy," he gasped. "I've me some brandy." I took out the decanter, and was about to help him, when he snatched it from me with a trembling hand, and poured out nearly half a tumbler of the spirit. He was usually a most abstemious man, but he took this off at a gulp without adding any water to it. It seemed to do him good, for the color began to come back to his face, and he leaned upon his elbow. "My engagement is off, Bob," he said, trying to speak calmly, but with a tremor in his voice which he could not conceal. "Tea is all over. Cheer up," I answered, trying to encourage him. "Don't get down on your luck. How was it? What was it all about?" "About?" he groaned, covering his face with his hands. "If I did tell you, Bob, you would not believe it. It is too dreadful, too horrible, unutterably awful and incredible. Oh, Kate, Kate." And he rocked himself to and fro in his grief. "I pictured you an angel, and I find you a what?" I asked, for he had paused. He looked at me with a vacant stare, and then suddenly burst out, waving his arms. "Fiend," he cried. "Ghoul from the pit. A vampire soul behind a lovely face. Now, God forgive me." He went on in a lower tone, turning his face to the wall. "I have said more than I should. I have loved her too much to speak of her as she is. I love her too much now." He lay still for some time, and I had hoped that the brandy had had the effect of sending him to sleep, when he suddenly turned his face towards me. "Did you ever read of werewolves?" he asked. I answered that I had. "There is a story," he said thoughtfully, "in one of Marryat's books, about a beautiful woman who took the form of a wolf at night, and devoured her own children. I wonder what put that idea into Marriott's head?" He pondered for some minutes, and then he cried out for some more brandy. There was a small bottle of laudanum upon the table, and I managed, by insisting upon helping him myself, to mix about half a drachm with the spirits. He drank it off, and sank his head once more upon the pillow. "Nothing better than that," he groaned. "Death is better than that. Crime and cruelty. Cruelty and crime. Anything is better than that," and so on, with the monotonous refrain, until at last the words became indistinct, his eyelids closed over his weary eyes, and he sank into a profound slumber. I carried him into his bedroom without arousing him, and making a couch for myself out of the chairs, I remained by his side all night. In the morning Barrington Coles was in a high fever. For weeks he lingered between life and death. The highest medical skill of Edinburgh was called in, and his vigorous constitution slowly got the better of his disease. I nursed him during this anxious time, but through all his wild delirium and ravings he never let a word escape him which explained the mystery connected with Miss Northcott. Sometimes he spoke of her in the tenderest words and most loving voice. At others he screamed out that she was a fiend, and stretched out his arms, as if to keep her off. Several times he cried that he would not sell his soul for a beautiful face, and then he would moan in a most piteous voice, "But I love her for all that. I shall never cease to love her." When he came to himself he was an altered man. His severe illness had emaciated him greatly, but his dark eyes had lost none of their brightness. They shone out with startling brilliance from under his dark, overhanging brows. His manner was eccentric and variable, sometimes irritable, sometimes recklessly mirthful, but never natural. He would glance about him in a strange, suspicious manner, like one who feared something, and yet hardly knew what it was he dreaded. He never mentioned Miss Northcott's name, never until that fatal evening of which I have now to speak. In an endeavor to break the current of his thoughts by frequent change of scene, I traveled with him through the Highlands of Scotland, and afterwards down the East Coast. In one of these peregrinations of ours we visited the Isle of May, an island near the mouth of the Firth of Forth, which, except in the tourist season, is singularly barren and desolate. Beyond the keeper of the lighthouse there are only one or two families of poor fisher-folk, who sustain a precarious existence by their nets, and by the capture of cormorants and solan geese. This grim spot seemed to have such a fascination for Coles, that we engaged a room in one of the fishermen's huts, with the intention of passing a week or two there. I found it very dull, but the loneliness appeared to be a relief to my friend's mind. He lost the look of apprehension which had become habitual to him, and became something like his old self. He would wander round the island all day, looking down from the summit of the great cliffs which gird it round, and watching the long green waves as they came booming in and burst in a shower of spray over the rocks beneath. One night, I think it was our third or fourth on the island, Barrington Coles and I went outside the cottage, before retiring to rest, to enjoy a little fresh air, for our room was small, and the rough lamp caused an unpleasant odor. How well I remember every little circumstance in connection with that night. It promised to be tempestuous, for the clouds were piling up in the northwest, and the dark rack was drifting across the face of the moon, throwing alternate belts of light and shade upon the rugged surface of the island and the restless sea beyond. We were standing talking close by the door of the cottage, and I was thinking to myself that my friend was more cheerful than he had been since his illness, when he gave a sudden, sharp cry, and looking round at him I saw, by the light of the moon, an expression of unutterable horror come over his features. His eyes became fixed and staring, as if riveted upon some approaching object, and he extended his long thin forefinger, which quivered as he pointed. "Look there," he cried. "T is she. It is she. You see her there coming down the side of the bray." He gripped me convulsively by the wrist as he spoke. "Here she is, coming towards us."
"Who?"
I cried, straining my eyes into the darkness.
"She, Kate, Kate Northcott," he screamed.
"He has come for me. Hold me fast, old friend. Don't let me go."
"Hold up, old man," I said, clapping him on the shoulder.
"Pull yourself together, you are dreaming, there is nothing to fear."
"She is gone," he cried, with a gasp of relief.
"Oh, by heaven! There she is again, and nearer, coming nearer. She told me she would come for me, and she keeps her word."
"Come into the house," I said.
His hand, as I grasped it, was as cold as ice.
"Ah, I knew it," he shouted.
"Here she is, waving her arms. She is beckoning to me. It is the signal. I must go. I am coming, Kate. I am coming." I threw my arms around him, but he burst from me with superhuman strength, and dashed into the darkness of the night. I followed him, calling to him to stop, but he ran the more swiftly. When the moon shone out between the clouds I could catch a glimpse of his dark figure, running rapidly in a straight line, as if to reach some definite goal. It may have been imagination, but it seemed to me that in the flickering light I could distinguish a vague something in front of him, a shimmering form which eluded his grasp, and led him onwards. I saw his outline stand out hard against the sky behind him as he surmounted the brow of a little hill, then he disappeared, and that was the last ever seen by mortal eye of Barrington Coles. The fisherman and I walked round the island all that night with lanterns, and examined every nook and corner without seeing a trace of my poor lost friend. The direction in which he had been running terminated in a rugged line of jagged cliffs overhanging the sea. At one place here the edge was somewhat crumbled, and there appeared marks upon the turf which might have been left by human feet. We lay upon our faces at this spot, and peered with our lanterns over the edge, looking down on the boiling surge 200 feet below. As we lay there, suddenly, above the beating of the waves, and the howling of the wind, there rose a strange wild screech from the abyss below. The fishermen, a naturally superstitious race, averred that it was the sound of a woman's laughter, and I could hardly persuade them to continue the search. For my own part I think it may have been the cry of some sea fowl startled from its nest by the flash of the lantern.
However that may be, I never wish to hear such a sound again. And now I have come to the end of the painful duty which I have undertaken. I have told as plainly and as accurately as I could the story of the death of John Barrington Coles, and the train of events which preceded it. I am aware that to others the sad episode seemed commonplace enough. Here is the prosaic account which appeared in the Scotsman a couple of days afterwards. Sad occurrence on the Isle of May. The Isle of May has been the scene of a sad disaster. Mr. John Barrington Coles, a gentleman well known in university circles as a most distinguished student, and the present holder of the Neil Arnott Prize for Physics, has been recruiting his health in this quiet retreat. The night before last he suddenly left his friend, Mr. Robert Armitage, and he has not since been heard of. It is almost certain that he has met his death by falling over the cliffs which surround the island. Mr. Cole's health has been failing for some time, partly from overstudy and partly from worry connected with family affairs. By his death the university loses one of her most promising alumni. I have nothing more to add to my statement. I have unburdened my mind of all that I know. I can well conceive that many, after weighing all that I have said, will see no ground for an accusation against Miss Northcott. They will say that, because a man of a naturally excitable disposition, says and does wild things, and even eventually commits self-murder after a sudden and heavy disappointment, there is no reason why vague charges should be advanced against a young lady. To this, I answer that they are welcome to their opinion. For my own part, I ascribe the death of William Prescott, of Archibald Reeves, and of John Barrington Coles to this woman with as much confidence as if I had seen her drive a dagger into their hearts. You ask me, no doubt, what my own theory is which will explain all these strange facts. I have none, or, at best, a dim and vague one. That Miss Northcott possessed extraordinary powers over the minds, and through the minds over the bodies, of others, I am convinced, as well as that her instincts were to use this power for base and cruel purposes. That some even more fiendish and terrible phase of character lay behind this, some horrible trait which it was necessary for her to reveal before marriage, is to be inferred from the experience of her three lovers, while the dreadful nature of the mystery thus revealed can only be surmised from the fact that the very mention of it drove from her those who had loved her so passionately. Their subsequent fate was, in my opinion, the result of her vindictive remembrance of their desertion of her, and that they were forewarned of it at the time, was shown by the words of both Reeves and Coles. Above this, I can say nothing. I lay the facts soberly before the public as they came under my notice. I have never seen Miss Northcott since, nor do I wish to do so. If by the words I have written I can save any one human being from the snare of those bright eyes and that beautiful face, then I can lay down my pen with the assurance that my poor friend has not died altogether in vain. Elias B. Hopkins, the parson of Jackman's Gulch. He was known in the Gulch as the Reverend Elias B. Hopkins, but it was generally understood that the title was an honorary one, extorted by his many eminent qualities, and not borne out by any legal claim which he could adduce. He parson was another of his sobriquets, which was sufficiently distinctive in a land where the flock was scattered and the shepherds few. To do him justice, he never pretended to have received any preliminary training for the ministry, or any orthodox qualification to practice it. "Ere all working in the claim of the Lord," he remarked one day, "and it don't matter a cent whether we're hired for the job, or whether we waltzes in on our own account," a piece of rough imagery which appealed directly to the instincts of Jackman's Gulch. It is quite certain that during the first few months his presence had a marked effect in diminishing the excessive use both of strong drinks and of stronger adjectives which had been characteristic of the little mining settlement. Under his tuition, men began to understand that the resources of their native language were less limited than they had supposed, and that it was possible to convey their impressions with accuracy without the aid of a gaudy halo of profanity. We were certainly in need of a regenerator at Jackman's Gulch about the beginning of 53. Times were flush then over the whole colony, but nowhere flusher than there. Our material prosperity had had a bad effect upon our morals. The camp was a small one, lying rather better than 120 miles to the north of Ballarat, at a spot where a mountain torrent finds its way down a rugged ravine on its way to join the Arrowsmith River. History does not relate who the original Jackman may have been, but at the time I speak of the camp it contained 100 or so adults, many of whom were men who had sought an asylum there, after making more civilized mining centers too hot to hold them. They were a rough, murderous crew, hardly leavened by the few respectable members of society who were scattered among them. Communication between Jackman's Gulch and the outside world was difficult and uncertain. A portion of the bush between it and Ballarat was infested by a redoubtable outlaw named Conky Jim, who, with a small band as desperate as himself, made traveling a dangerous matter. It was customary, therefore, at the Gulch, to store up the dust and nuggets obtained from the mines in a special store, each man's share being placed in a separate bag on which his name was marked. A trusty man, named Wobburn, was deputed to watch over this primitive bank. When the amount deposited became considerable, a wagon was hired, and the whole treasure was conveyed to Ballarat, guarded by the police, and by a certain number of miners, who took it in turn to perform the office. Once in Ballarat, it was forwarded on to Melbourne by the regular gold wagons. By this plan the gold was often kept 4 months in the gulch before being dispatched, but Conky Jim was effectually checkmated, as the escort party were far too strong for him and his gang. He appeared, at the time of which I write, to have forsaken his haunts in disgust, and the road could be traversed by small parties with impunity. Comparative order used to reign during the daytime at Jackman's Gulch, for the majority of the inhabitants were out with Crowbar and pick among the quartz ledges, or washing clay and sand in their cradles by the banks of the little stream. As the sun sank down, however, the claims were gradually deserted, and their unkempt owners, clay bespattered and shaggy, came lounging into camp, ripe for any form of mischief. Their first visit was to Wobburn's gold store, where their cleanup of the day was duly deposited, the amount being entered in the storekeeper's book, and each miner retaining enough to cover his evening's expenses. After that, all restraint was at an end, and each set to work to get rid of his surplus dust with the greatest rapidity possible. The focus of dissipation was the rough bar, formed by a couple of hogsheads spanned by planks, which was dignified by the name of the Britannia Drinking Saloon. Here Nat Adams, the burly barkeeper, dispensed bad whiskey at the rate of 2 shillings a noggin, or a guinea a bottle, while his brother Ben acted as croupier in the rude wooden shanty behind, which had been converted into a gambling hell, and was crowded every night. There had been a third brother, but an unfortunate misunderstanding with a customer had shortened his existence. He was too soft to live long, his brother Nathaniel feelingly observed, on the occasion of his funeral. Many's the time I've said to him, "If you're arguing a pint with a stranger, you should always draw first, then argue, and then shoot, if you judge that he's on the shoot." Bill was too perlite. He must needs argue first and draw after, when he might just as well have kivered his man, before talking it over with him. This amiable weakness of the deceased Bill was a blow to the firm of Adams, which became so short-handed that the concern could hardly be worked without the admission of a partner, which would mean a considerable decrease in the profits. Nat Adams had had a roadside shanty in the gulch before the discovery of gold, and might, therefore, claim to be the oldest inhabitant. These keepers of shanties were a peculiar race, and at the cost of a digression it may be interesting to explain how they managed to amass considerable sums of money in a land where travelers were few and far between. It was the custom of the bushmen, i.e., bullock drivers, sheep tenders, and the other white hands who worked on the sheep runs up country, to sign articles by which they agreed to serve their master for 1, 2, or 3 years at so much per year and certain daily rations. Liquor was never included in this agreement, and the men remained, perforce, total abstainers during the whole time. The money was paid in a lump sum at the end of the engagement. When that day came round, Jimmy, the stockman, would come slouching into his master's office, cabbage tree hat in hand. "Morning, master," Jimmy would say. "Why, time's up. I guess I'll draw my check and ride down to town."
"You'll come back, Jimmy?"
"Yes, I'll come back. Maybe I'll be away 3 weeks, maybe a month. I want some clothes, master, and my bloomin' boots are well nigh off my feet."
"How much, Jimmy?"
asks his master, taking up his pen. "There's 60-pound screw," Jimmy answers thoughtfully.
"And you mind, master, last March, when the brindled bull broke out o' the paddock?
2 pound you promised me then.
And 1 pound at the dipping. And 1 pound when Miller's sheep got mixed with Orne."
And so he goes on. Four bushmen can seldom write, but they have memories which nothing escapes.
His master writes the check, and hands it across the table.
"On, get on the drink, Jimmy," he says.
"No fear of that, master," and the stockman slips the check into his leather pouch, and within an hour he is ambling off upon his long-limbed horse on his 100-mile journey to town. Now Jimmy has to pass some 6 or 8 of the above-mentioned roadside shanties in his day's ride, and experience has taught him that, if he once breaks his accustomed total abstinence, the unwonted stimulant has an overpowering effect upon his brain. Jimmy shakes his head warily as he determines that no earthly consideration will induce him to partake of any liquor until his business is over. His only chance is to avoid temptation. So, knowing that there is the first of these houses some half mile ahead, he plunges into a bypath through the bush which will lead him out at the other side. Jimmy is riding resolutely along this narrow path, congratulating himself upon a danger escaped, when he becomes aware of a sunburned, black-bearded man who is leaning unconcernedly against a tree beside the track. This is none other than the shanty keeper, who, having observed Jimmy's maneuver in the distance, has taken a short cut through the bush in order to intercept him.
"Morning, Jimmy," he cries, as the horseman comes up to him.
"Morning, mate, morning. Where are ye off to today then?"
"Off to town," says Jimmy sturdily.
"No, now, are you though?
You'll have bully times down there for a bit. Come round and have a drink at my place. Just by way of luck."
"No," says Jimmy, "I don't want a drink. Just a little damp."
"I tell ye I don't want one," says the stockman angrily.
"Well, ye needn't be so darn short about it. It's nothing to me, whether you drinks or not.
Good morning."
"Good morning," says Jimmy, and has ridden on about 20 yards, when he hears the other calling on him to stop.
"See here, Jimmy," he says, overtaking him again. "If you'll do me a kindness, when you're up in town I'd be obliged."
"What is it?"
"It's a letter, Jim, as I once posted. It's an important one too, and I wouldn't trust it with everyone. But I knows you, and if you'll take charge on it, it'll be a powerful weight off my mind."
"Give it here," Jimmy says laconically.
"I ain't got it here. It's round in my caboose. Come round for it with me. It ain't more'n 1/4 of a mile.
Jimmy consents reluctantly. When they reach the tumble-down hut, the keeper asks him cheerily to dismount and to come in.
"Give me the letter," says Jimmy. "It ain't altogether wrote yet, but you sit down here for a minute, and it'll be right."
And so the stockman is beguiled into the shanty. At last the letter is ready and handed over.
"Ow, Jimmy," says the keeper, "one drink at my expense before you go."
"Not a taste," says Jimmy.
"Oh, that's it, is it?"
the other says in an aggrieved tone. "You're too damned proud to drink with a poor cove like me.
Here, give us back that letter.
I'm cursed if I'll accept a favor from a man who's too almighty big to have a drink with me."
"Well, well, mate, don't turn rusty," says Jim.
"I've us one drink and I'm off."
The keeper pours out about half a pannikin of raw rum and hands it to the bushman. The moment he smells the old familiar smell his longing for it returns, and he swigs it off at a gulp. His eyes shine more brightly, and his face becomes flushed.
The keeper watches him narrowly.
"Who can go now, Jim?" he says.
"Steady, mate, steady," says the bushman.
"I'm as good a man as you. If you stand a drink I can stand one too, I suppose."
So the pannikin is replenished, and Jimmy's eyes shine brighter still.
"Now, Jimmy, one last drink for the good of the house, says the keeper, and then it's time you were off. The stockman has a third gulp from the pannikin, and with it all his scruples and good resolutions vanish forever. Look here, he says somewhat huskily, taking his check out of his pouch. Who take this, mate? Whoever comes along this road, ask them what they'll have, and tell them it's my shout. Let me know when the money's done. So Jimmy abandons the idea of ever getting to town, and for 3 weeks or a month he lies about the shanty in a state of extreme drunkenness, and reduces every wayfarer upon the road to the same condition. At last one fine morning the keeper comes to him. He coins done, Jimmy, he says, it's about time you made some more. So Jimmy has a good wash to sober him, straps his blanket and his billy to his back, and rides off through the bush to the sheep run, where he has another year of sobriety, terminating in another month of intoxication. All this, though typical of the happy-go-lucky manners of the inhabitants, has no direct bearing upon Jackman's Gulch, so we must return to that Arcadian settlement. Additions to the population there were not numerous, and such as came about the time of which I speak, were even rougher and fiercer than the original inhabitants. In particular, there came a brace of ruffians named Phillips and Maul, who rode into camp one day, and started a claim upon the other side of the stream. They outgulched the gulch in the virulence and fluency of their blasphemy, in the truculence of their speech and manner, and in their reckless disregard of all social laws. They claimed to have come from Bendigo, and there were some amongst us who wished that the redoubted Conky Jim was on the track once more, as long as he would close it to such visitors as these. After their arrival the nightly proceedings at the Britannia Bar, and at the gambling hell behind it became more riotous than ever. Violent quarrels, frequently ending in bloodshed, were of constant occurrence. The more peaceable frequenters of the bar began to talk seriously of lynching the two strangers who were the principal promoters of disorder. Things were in this unsatisfactory condition when our evangelist, Elias B. Hopkins, came limping into the camp, travel-stained and footsore, with his spade strapped across his back, and his Bible in the pocket of his moleskin jacket. His presence was hardly noticed at first, so insignificant was the man. His manner was quiet and unobtrusive, his face pale, and his figure fragile. On better acquaintance, however, there was a squareness and firmness about his clean-shaven lower jaw, and an intelligence in his widely opened blue eyes, which marked him as a man of character. He erected a small hut for himself, and started a claim close to that occupied by the two strangers who had preceded him. This claim was chosen with a ludicrous disregard for all practical laws of mining, and at once stamped the newcomer as being a green hand at his work. It was piteous to observe him every morning as we passed to our work, digging and delving with the greatest industry, but, as we knew well, without the smallest possibility of any result. He would pause for a moment as we went by, wipe his pale face with his bandana handkerchief, and shout out to us a cordial morning greeting, and then fall to again with redoubled energy. By degrees we got into the way of making a half-pitying, half-contemptuous inquiry as to how he got on. "Ain't struck it yet, boys," he would answer cheerily, leaning on his spade, "but the bedrock lies deep just hereabouts, and I reckon we'll get among the pay gravel today." Day after day he returned the same reply with unvarying confidence and cheerfulness. It was not long before he began to show us the stuff that was in him. One night the proceedings were unusually violent at the drinking saloon. A rich pocket had been struck during the day, and the striker was standing treat in a lavish and promiscuous fashion which had reduced three parts of the settlement to a state of wild intoxication. A crowd of drunken idlers stood, or lay about the bar, cursing, swearing, shouting, dancing, and here and there firing their pistols into the air out of pure wantonness. From the interior of the shanty behind there came a similar chorus. Maul, Phillips, and the roughs who followed them were in the ascendant, and all order and decency was swept away. Suddenly, amid this tumult of oaths and drunken cries, men became conscious of a quiet monotone which underlay all other sounds, and obtruded itself at every pause in the uproar. Gradually first one man, and then another paused to listen, until there was a general cessation of the hubbub, and every eye was turned in the direction whence this quiet stream of words flowed. There, mounted upon a barrel, was Elias B. Hopkins, the newest of the inhabitants of Jackman's Gulch, with a good-humored smile upon his resolute face. He held an open Bible in his hand, and was reading aloud a passage taken at random, an extract from the Apocalypse, if I remember right. The words were entirely irrelevant, and without the smallest bearing upon the scene before him, but he plodded on with great unction, waving his left hand slowly to the cadence of his words. There was a general shout of laughter and applause at this apparition, and Jackman's Gulch gathered round the barrel approvingly, under the impression that this was some ornate joke, and that they were about to be treated to some mock sermon or parody of the chapter read. When, however, the reader, having finished the chapter, placidly commenced another, and having finished that rippled on into another one, the revelers came to the conclusion that the joke was somewhat too long-winded. The commencement of yet another chapter confirmed this opinion, and an angry chorus of shouts and cries, with suggestions as to gagging the reader or knocking him off the barrel, rose from every side. In spite of roars and hoots, however, Elias B. Hopkins plodded away at the Apocalypse with the same serene countenance, looking as ineffably contented as though the babel around him were the most gratifying applause. Before long an occasional boot pattered against the barrel, or whistled past our parson's head. But here some of the more orderly of the inhabitants interfered in favor of peace and order, aided curiously enough by the aforementioned Maul and Phillips, who warmly espoused the cause of the little scripture reader. "He little cuss has got grit in him," the latter explained, rearing his bulky red-shirted form between the crowd and the object of its anger. "His ways ain't our ways, and we're all welcome to our opinions, and to sling them round from barrels or otherwise if so minded. What I says, and Bill says is, that when it comes to slinging boots instead o' words it's too steep by half, and if this man's wronged we'll chip in, and see him righted." This oratorical effort had the effect of checking the more active signs of disapproval, and the party of disorder attempted to settle down once more to their carouse, and to ignore the shower of scripture which was poured upon them. The attempt was hopeless. The drunken portion fell asleep under the drowsy refrain, and the others, with many a sullen glance at the imperturbable reader, slouched off to their huts, leaving him still perched upon the barrel. Finding himself alone with the more orderly of the spectators, the little man rose, closed his book, after methodically marking with a lead pencil the exact spot at which he stopped, and descended from his perch. "Oh, morrow night, boys," he remarked in his quiet voice, "the reading will commence at the 9th verse of the 15th chapter of the Apocalypse," with which piece of information, disregarding our congratulations, he walked away with the air of a man who has performed an obvious duty. We found that his parting words were no empty threat. Hardly had the crowd begun to assemble next night, before he appeared once more upon the barrel, and began to read with the same monotonous vigor, tripping over words, muddling up sentences, but still boring along through chapter after chapter. Laughter, threats, chaff, every weapon short of actual violence, was used to deter him, but all with the same want of success. Soon it was found that there was a method in his proceedings. When silence reigned, or when the conversation was of an innocent nature, the reading ceased. A single word of blasphemy, however, set it going again, and it would ramble on for a quarter of an hour or so, when it stopped, only to be renewed upon similar provocation. The reading was pretty continuous during that second night, for the language of the opposition was still considerably free. At least it was an improvement upon the night before. For more than a month Elias B. Hopkins carried on this campaign. There he would sit, night after night, with the open book upon his knee, and at the slightest provocation off he would go, like a musical box, when the spring is touched. The monotonous drawl became unendurable, but it could only be avoided by conforming to the Parsons Code. A chronic swearer came to be looked upon with disfavor by the community, since the punishment of his transgression fell upon all. At the end of a fortnight the reader was silent more than half the time, and at the end of the month his position was a sinecure. Never was a moral revolution brought about more rapidly and more completely. Our parson carried his principle into private life. I have seen him, on hearing an unguarded word from some worker in the gulches, rush across, Bible in hand, and perching himself upon the heap of red clay which surmounted the offender's claim, drawl through the genealogical tree at the commencement of the New Testament in a most earnest and impressive manner, as though it were especially appropriate to the occasion. In time, an oath became a rare thing amongst us. Drunkenness was on the wane too. Casual travelers passing through the gulch used to marvel at our state of grace, and rumors of it went as far as Ballarat, and excited much comment there. There were points about our evangelist which made him especially fitted for the work which he had undertaken. A man entirely without redeeming vices would have had no common basis on which to work, and no means of gaining the sympathy of his flock. As we came to know Elias B. Hopkins better, we discovered that in spite of his piety there was a leaven of old Adam in him, and that he had certainly known unregenerate days. He was no teetotaler. On the contrary, he could choose his liquor with discrimination, and lower it in an able manner. He played a masterly hand at poker, and there were few who could touch him at a throat euchre. He and the two ex-ruffians, Phillips and Maul, used to play 4 hours in perfect harmony, except when the fall of the cards elicited an oath from one of his companions. At the first of these offenses the parson would put on a pained smile, and gaze reproachfully at the culprit. At the second he would reach for his Bible, and the game was over for the evening. He showed us he was a good revolver shot too, for when we were practicing at an empty brandy bottle outside Adam's bar, he took up a friend's pistol, and hit it plumb in the center at 24 paces. There were few things he took up, that he could not make a show at apparently, except gold dash digging, and at that he was the veriest duffer alive. It was pitiful to see the little canvas bag, with his name printed across it, lying placid and empty upon the shelf at Woburn's store, while all the other bags were increasing daily, and some had assumed quite a portly rotundity of form, for the weeks were slipping by, and it was almost time for the gold train to start off for Ballarat. We reckoned that the amount which we had stored at the time represented the greatest sum which had ever been taken by a single convoy out of Jackman's Gulch. Although Elias B. Hopkins appeared to derive a certain quiet satisfaction from the wonderful change which he had effected in the camp, his joy was not yet rounded and complete. There was one thing for which he still yearned. He opened his heart to us about it one evening. "We'd have a blessing on the camp, boys," he said, "if we only had a service o' some sort on the Lord's Day. It's a tempt to no providence, to go on in this way without taking any notice of it, except that maybe there's more whiskey drunk, and more card playing than on any other day." "We ain't got no parson," objected one of the crowd. "Ye fool," growled another, "ain't we got a man as is worth any three parsons, and can splash texts around like clay out o' a cradle? What more do you want?" "We ain't got no church," urged the same dissentient. "Have it in the open air," one suggested. "Or in Woburn's store," said another. "Or in Adam's saloon." The last proposal was received with a buzz of approval, which showed that it was considered the most appropriate locality. Adam's saloon was a substantial wooden building in the rear of the bar, which was used partly for storing liquor, and partly for a gambling saloon. It was strongly built of rough-hewn logs, the proprietor rightly judging, in the unregenerate days of Jackman's Gulch, that hogsheads of brandy and rum were commodities which had best be secured under lock and key. A strong door opened into each end of the saloon, and the interior was spacious enough, when the table and lumber were cleared away, to accommodate the whole population. The spirit barrels were heaped together at one end by their owner, so as to make a very fair imitation of a pulpit. At first the gulch took but a mild interest in the proceedings, but when it became known that Elias B. Hopkins intended, after reading the service, to address the audience, the settlement began to warm up to the occasion. A real sermon was a novelty to all of them, and one coming from their own parson was additionally so. Rumor announced that it would be interspersed with local hits, and that the moral would be pointed by pungent personalities. Men began to fear that they would be unable to gain seats, and many applications were made to the brothers Adams. It was only when conclusively shown that the saloon could contain them all with a margin that the camp settled down into calm expectancy. It was as well that the building was of such a size, for the assembly upon the Sunday morning was the largest which had ever occurred in the annals of Jackman's Gulch. At first it was thought that the whole population was present, but a little reflection showed that this was not so. Maul and Phillips had gone on a prospecting journey among the hills, and had not returned as yet, and Wobburn, the goalkeeper, was unable to leave his store. Having a very large quantity of the precious metal under his charge, he stuck to his post, feeling that the responsibility was too great to trifle with. With these three exceptions, the whole of the gulch, with clean red shirts, and such other additions to their toilet as the occasion demanded, sauntered in a straggling line along the clay pathway which led up to the saloon. The interior of the building had been provided with rough benches, and the parson, with his quiet good-humored smile, was standing at the door to welcome them. "Good morning, boys," he cried cheerily, as each group came lounging up. "Pass in, pass in. You'll find this is as good a morning's work as any you've done. Leave your pistols in this barrel outside the door as you pass. You can pick them out as you come out again, but it isn't the thing to carry weapons into the house of peace." His request was good-humoredly complied with, and before the last of the congregation filed in, there was a strange assortment of knives and firearms in this depository. When all had assembled, the doors were shut, and the service began, the first and the last which was ever performed at Jackman's Gulch. The weather was sultry, and the room close, yet the miners listened with exemplary patience. There was a sense of novelty in the situation which had its attractions. To some it was entirely new, others were wafted back by it to another land and other days. Beyond a disposition which was exhibited by the uninitiated to applaud at the end of certain prayers, by way of showing that they sympathized with the sentiments expressed, no audience could have behaved better. There was a murmur of interest, however, when Elias B. Hopkins, looking down on the congregation from his rostrum of casks, began his address. He had attired himself with care in honor of the occasion. He wore a velveteen tunic, girt round the waist with a sash of China silk, a pair of moleskin trousers, and held his cabbage tree hat in his left hand. He began speaking in a low tone, and it was noticed at the time that he frequently glanced through the small aperture which served for a window which was placed above the heads of those who sat beneath him. "I've put you straight now," he said, in the course of his address. "I've got you in the right rut, if you will, but stick in it." Here he looked very hard out of the window for some seconds. "You have learned soberness and industry, and with those things you can always make up any loss you may sustain. I guess there isn't one of ye that won't remember my visit to this camp." He paused for a moment, and three revolver shots rang out upon the quiet summer air. "Keep your seats, damn ye," roared our preacher, as his audience rose in excitement. "If a man of ye moves down he goes. The door's locked on the outside, so ye can't get out anyhow. Your seats, ye canting, chuckle-headed fools. Down with ye, ye dogs, or I'll fire among ye." Astonishment and fear brought us back into our seats, and we sat staring blankly at our pastor and each other. Elias B. Hopkins, whose whole face, and even figure appeared to have undergone an extraordinary alteration, looked fiercely down on us from his commanding position, with a contemptuous smile on his stern face. "I have your lives in my hands," he remarked, and we noticed as he spoke that he held a heavy revolver in his hand, and that the butt of another one protruded from his sash. "I'm armed and you are not. If one of you moves or speaks, he is a dead man. If not, I shall not harm you. You must wait here for an hour." "Why, you fools," this with a hiss of contempt which rang in our ears for many a long day, Do you know who it is that has stuck you up? Do you know who it is that has been playing it upon you for months as a parson and a saint? Conky Jim, the Bushranger, Yates. And Phillips and Maul were my two right-hand men. They're off into the hills with your gold, ha! Would he? This to some rest of member of the audience, who quieted down instantly before the fierce eye and the ready weapon of the Bushranger. In an hour they will be clear of any pursuit, and I advise you to make the best of it, and not to follow, or you may lose more than your money. My horse is tethered outside this door behind me. When the time is up I shall pass through it, lock it on the outside, and be off. Then you may break your way out as best you can. I have no more to say to you, except that ye are the most cursed set of asses that ever trod in boot leather. We had time to endorse mentally this outspoken opinion during the long 60 minutes which followed. We were powerless before the resolute desperado. It is true that if we made a simultaneous rush we might bear him down at the cost of 8 or 10 of our number. But how could such a rush be organized without speaking, and who would attempt it without a previous agreement that he would be supported? There was nothing for it but submission. It seemed 3 hours at the least before the ranger snapped up his watch, stepped down from the barrel, walked backwards, still covering us with his weapon, to the door behind him, and then passed rapidly through it. We heard the creaking of the rusty lock, and the clatter of his horse's hoofs, as he galloped away. It has been remarked that an oath had, for the last few weeks, been a rare thing in the camp. We made up for our temporary abstention during the next half hour. Never was heard such symmetrical and heartfelt blasphemy. When at last we succeeded in getting the door off its hinges, all sight of both rangers and treasure had disappeared, nor have we ever caught sight of either the one or the other since. Poor Wobburn, true to his trust, lay shot through the head across the threshold of his empty store. The villains, Maul and Phillips, had descended upon the camp the instant that we had been enticed into the trap, murdered the keeper, loaded up a small cart with the booty, and got safe away to some wild fastness among the mountains, where they were joined by their wily leader. Jackman's Gulch recovered from this blow, and is now a flourishing township. Social reformers are not in request there, however, and morality is at a discount. It is said that an inquest has been held lately upon an unoffending stranger who chanced to remark that in so large a place it would be advisable to have some form of Sunday service. The memory of their one and only pastor is still green among the inhabitants, and will be for many a long year to come. The Ring of Thoth. Mr. John Van Siddert Smith, F. R.R. South, of 147 Agour Street, was a man whose energy of purpose and clearness of thought might have placed him in the very first rank of scientific observers. He was the victim, however, of a universal ambition which prompted him to aim at distinction in many subjects, rather than preeminence in one. In his early days he had shown an aptitude for zoology and for botany which caused his friends to look upon him as a second Darwin, but when a professorship was almost within his reach he had suddenly discontinued his studies and turned his whole attention to chemistry. Here his researches upon the spectra of the metals had won him his fellowship in the Royal Society, but again he played the coquette with his subject, and after a year's absence from the laboratory he joined the Oriental Society, and delivered a paper on the hieroglyphic and demotic inscriptions of El-Kab, thus giving a crowning example both of the versatility and of the inconstancy of his talents. The most fickle of wooers, however, is apt to be caught at last, and so it was with John Van Siddert Smith. The more he burrowed his way into Egyptology, the more impressed he became by the vast field which it opened to the inquirer, and by the extreme importance of a subject which promised to throw a light upon the first germs of human civilization, and the origin of the greater part of our arts and sciences. So struck was Mr. Smith that he straightway married an Egyptological young lady who had written upon the 6th dynasty, and having thus secured a sound base of operations he set himself to collect materials for a work which should unite the research of Lepsius and the ingenuity of Champollion. The preparation of this magnum opus entailed many hurried visits to the magnificent Egyptian collections of the Louvre, upon the last of which, no longer ago than the middle of last October, he became involved in a most strange and noteworthy adventure. The trains had been slow, and the channel had been rough, so that the student arrived in Paris in a somewhat befogged and feverish condition. On reaching the Hotel de France, in the Rue Lafitte, he had thrown himself upon a sofa for a couple of hours, but finding that he was unable to sleep, he determined, in spite of his fatigue, to make his way to the Louvre, settle the point which he had come to decide, and take the evening train back to Dieppe. Having come to this conclusion, he donned his greatcoat, for it was a raw rainy day, and made his way across the Boulevard des Italiens, and down the Avenue de la Pira. Once in the Louvre he was on familiar ground, and he speedily made his way to the collection of papyri which it was his intention to consult. The warmest admirers of John Van Siddert Smith could hardly claim for him that he was a handsome man. His high beaked nose and prominent chin had something of the same acute and incisive character which distinguished his intellect. He held his head in a bird-like fashion, and bird-like too was the pecking motion with which, in conversation, he threw out his objections and retorts. As he stood, with the high collar of his greatcoat raised to his ears, he might have seen from the reflection in the glass case before him that his appearance was a singular one. Yet it came upon him as a sudden jar, when an English voice behind him exclaimed in very audible tones, "What a queer-looking mortal!" The student had a large amount of petty vanity in his composition which manifested itself by an ostentatious and overdone disregard of all personal considerations. He straightened his lips and looked rigidly at the roll of papyrus, while his heart filled with bitterness against the whole race of traveling Britons. "Yes," said another voice, "he really is an extraordinary fellow." "Do you know," said the first speaker, "one could almost believe that by the continual contemplation of mummies the chap has become half a mummy himself?" "He has certainly an Egyptian cast of countenance," said the other. John Van Siddert Smith spun round upon his heel with the intention of shaming his countrymen by a corrosive remark or two. To his surprise and relief, the two young fellows who had been conversing at their shoulders turned towards him, and were gazing at one of the Louvre attendants who was polishing some brasswork at the other side of the room. "Carter will be waiting for us at the Palace Royal," said one tourist to the other, glancing at his watch, and they clattered away, leaving the student to his labors. "I wonder what these chatterers call an Egyptian cast of countenance," thought John Van Siddert Smith, and he moved his position slightly in order to catch a glimpse of the man's face. He started as his eyes fell upon it. It was indeed the very face with which his studies had made him familiar. The regular statuesque features, broad brow, well-rounded chin, and dusky complexion were the exact counterpart of the innumerable statues, mummy cases, and pictures which adorned the walls of the apartment. The thing was beyond all coincidence. The man must be an Egyptian. The national angularity of the shoulders and narrowness of the hips were alone sufficient to identify him. John Van Siddert Smith shuffled towards the attendant with some intention of addressing him. He was not light of touch in conversation, and found it difficult to strike the happy mean between the brusqueness of the superior and the geniality of the equal. As he came nearer, the man presented his side face to him, but kept his gaze still bent upon his work. Van Siddert Smith, fixing his eyes upon the fellow's skin, was conscious of a sudden impression that there was something inhuman and preternatural about its appearance. Over the temple and cheekbone it was as glazed and as shiny as varnished parchment. There was no suggestion of pores. One could not fancy a drop of moisture upon that arid surface. From brow to chin, however, it was cross-hatched by a million delicate wrinkles, which shot and interlaced, as though nature in some mad-eye mood had tried how wild and intricate a pattern she could devise. "Où est la collection de Memphis?" asked the student, with the awkward air of a man who is devising a question merely for the purpose of opening a conversation. "Qu'est la," replied the man brusquely, nodding his head at the other side of the room. "Vous êtes un Egyptien, n'est-ce pas?" asked the Englishman. The attendant looked up and turned his strange dark eyes upon his questioner. They were vitreous, with a misty dry shininess, such as Smith had never seen in a human head before. As he gazed into them, he saw some strong emotion gather in their depths, which rose and deepened until it broke into a look of something akin both to horror and to hatred. "Non, Monsieur, Jesus Francis." The man turned abruptly and bent low over his polishing. The student gazed at him for a moment in astonishment, and then turning to a chair in a retired corner behind one of the doors, he proceeded to make notes of his researches among the papyri. His thoughts, however, refused to return into their natural groove. They would run upon the enigmatical attendant with the sphinx-like face and the parchment skin. "Where have I seen such eyes?" said Van Sittert Smith to himself. "There is something saurian about them, something reptilian. There's the membrana nictitans of the snakes," he mused, bethinking himself of his zoological studies. "Tea gives a shiny effect. But there was something more here. There was a sense of power, of wisdom, so I read them, and of weariness, utter weariness, and ineffable despair. It may be all imagination, but I never had so strong an impression. By Jove, I must have another look at them." He rose and paced around the Egyptian rooms, but the man who had excited his curiosity had disappeared. The student sat down again in his quiet corner and continued to work at his notes. He had gained the information which he required from the papyri, and it only remained to write it down while it was still fresh in his memory. For a time his pencil traveled rapidly over the paper, but soon the lines became less level, the words more blurred, and finally the pencil tinkled down upon the floor, and the head of the student dropped heavily forward upon his chest. Tired out by his journey, he slept so soundly in his lonely post behind the door, that neither the clanking civil guard, nor the footsteps of sightseers, nor even the loud horse bell which gives the signal for closing, were sufficient to arouse him. Twilight deepened into darkness, the bustle from the Rue de Rivoli waxed and then waned. Distant Notre Dame clanged out the hour of midnight, and still the dark and lonely figure sat silently in the shadow. It was not until close upon one in the morning that, with a sudden gasp and an intaking of the breath, Van Sittert Smith returned to consciousness. For a moment it flashed upon him that he had dropped asleep in his study chair at home. The moon was shining fitfully through the unshuttered window, however, and, as his eye ran along the lines of mummies and the endless array of polished cases, he remembered clearly where he was and how he came there. The student was not a nervous man. He possessed that love of a novel situation which is peculiar to his race. Stretching out his cramped limbs, he looked at his watch and burst into a chuckle as he observed the hour. The episode would make an admirable anecdote, to be introduced into his next paper as a relief to the graver and heavier speculations. He was a little cold, but wide awake and much refreshed. It was no wonder that the guardians had overlooked him, for the door threw its heavy black shadow right across him. The complete silence was impressive. Neither outside nor inside was there a creak or a murmur. He was alone with the dead men of a dead civilization. What though the outer city reeked of the garish 19th century? In all this chamber there was scarce an article, from the shriveled ear of wheat to the pigment box of the painter, which had not held its own against 4,000 years. Here was the flotsam and jetsam washed up by the great ocean of time from that far-off empire. From stately Thebes, from lordly Luxor, from the great temples of Heliopolis, from 100 rifled tombs, these relics had been brought. The student glanced round at the long silent figures who flickered vaguely up through the gloom, at the busy toilers who were now so restful, and he fell into a reverent and thoughtful mood. An unwonted sense of his own youth and insignificance came over him. Leaning back in his chair, he gazed dreamily down the long vista of rooms, all silvery with the moonshine, which extend through the whole wing of the widespread building. His eyes fell upon the yellow glare of a distant lamp. John Van Sittert Smith sat up on his chair with his nerves all on edge. The light was advancing slowly towards him, pausing from time to time, and then coming jerkily onwards. The bearer moved noiselessly. In the utter silence there was no suspicion of the pad of a footfall. An idea of robbers entered the Englishman's head. He snuggled up further into the corner. The light was two rooms off. Now it was in the next chamber, and still there was no sound. With something approaching to a thrill of fear, the student observed a face, floating in the air as it were, behind the flare of the lamp. The figure was wrapped in shadow, but the light fell full upon the strange eager face. There was no mistaking the metallic glistening eyes and the cadaverous skin. It was the attendant with whom he had conversed. Van Sittert Smith's first impulse was to come forward and address him. A few words of explanation would set the matter clear, and lead doubtless to his being conducted to some side door from which he might make his way to his hotel. As the man entered the chamber, however, there was something, so stealthy in his movements, and so furtive in his expression, that the Englishman altered his intention. This was clearly no ordinary official walking the rounds. The fellow wore felt-soled slippers, stepped with a rising chest, and glanced quickly from left to right, while his hurried gasping breathing thrilled the flame of his lamp. Van Sittert Smith crouched silently back into the corner, and watched him keenly, convinced that his air, and was one of secret and probably sinister import. There was no hesitation in the other's movements. He stepped lightly and swiftly across to one of the great cases, and, drawing a key from his pocket, he unlocked it. From the upper shelf he pulled down a mummy, which he bore away with him, and laid it with much care and solicitude upon the ground. By it he placed his lamp, and then squatting down beside it in Eastern fashion he began with long quivering fingers to undo the cerecloths and bandages which girded it round. As the crackling rolls of linen peeled off one after the other, a strong aromatic odor filled the chamber, and fragments of scented wood and of spices pattered down upon the marble floor. It was clear to John Van Sittert Smith that this mummy had never been unswathed before. The operation interested him keenly. He thrilled all over with curiosity, and his bird-like head protruded further and further from behind the door. When, however, the last roll had been removed from the 4,000-year-old head, it was all that he could do to stifle an outcry of amazement. First, a cascade of long, black, glossy tresses poured over the workman's hands and arms. A second turn of the bandage revealed a low, white forehead, with a pair of delicately arched eyebrows. A third uncovered a pair of bright, deeply fringed eyes, and a straight, well-cut nose, while a fourth and last showed a sweet, full, sensitive mouth, and a beautifully curved chin. The whole face was one of extraordinary loveliness, save for the one blemish that in the center of the forehead there was a single irregular, coffee-colored splotch. It was a triumph of the embalmer's art. Van Sittert Smith's eyes grew larger and larger as he gazed upon it, and he chirruped in his throat with satisfaction. Its effect upon the Egyptologist was as nothing, however, compared with that which it produced upon the strange attendant. He threw his hands up into the air, burst into a harsh clatter of words, and then, hurling himself down upon the ground beside the mummy, he threw his arms round her, and kissed her repeatedly upon the lips and brow. A petite. He groaned in French. A pauvre petite. His voice broke with emotion, and his innumerable wrinkles quivered and writhed, but the student observed in the lamplight that his shining eyes were still as dry and tearless as two beads of steel. For some minutes he lay, with a twitching face, crooning and moaning over the beautiful head. Then he broke into a sudden smile, said some words in an unknown tongue, and sprang to his feet with the vigorous air of one who has braced himself for an effort. In the center of the room there was a large circular case which contained, as the student had frequently remarked, a magnificent collection of early Egyptian rings and precious stones. To this the attendant strode, and, unlocking it, he threw it open. On the ledge at the side he placed his lamp, and beside it a small earthenware jar which he had drawn from his pocket. He then took a handful of rings from the case, and with a most serious and anxious face he proceeded to smear each in turn with some liquid substance from the earthen pot, holding them to the light as he did so. He was clearly disappointed with the first lot, for he threw them petulantly back into the case, and drew out some more. One of these, a massive ring with a large crystal set in it, he seized and eagerly tested with the contents of the jar. Instantly he uttered a cry of joy, and threw out his arms in a wild gesture which upset the pot, and sent the liquid streaming across the floor to the very feet of the Englishman. The attendant drew a red handkerchief from his bosom, and, mopping up the mess, he followed it into the corner, where in a moment he found himself face to face with his observer. "Excuse me," said John Van Siddert Smith, with all imaginable politeness. "I have been unfortunate enough to fall asleep behind this door." "And you have been watching me?" the other asked in English, with a most venomous look on his corpse-like face. The student was a man of veracity. "Confess," said he, "that I have noticed your movements, and that they have aroused my curiosity and interest in the highest degree." The man drew a long flamboyant bladed knife from his bosom. "You have had a very narrow escape," he said. "Had I seen you 10 minutes ago, I should have driven this through your heart. As it is, if you touch me, or interfere with me in any way, you are a dead man." "I have no wish to interfere with you," the student answered. "My presence here is entirely accidental. All I ask is that you will have the extreme kindness to show me out through some side door." He spoke with great suavity, for the man was still pressing the tip of his dagger against the palm of his left hand, as though to assure himself of its sharpness, while his face preserved its malignant expression. "If I thought," said he. "But no, perhaps it is as well. What is your name?" The Englishman gave it. "Van Siddert Smith," the other repeated. "Are you the same Van Siddert Smith who gave a paper in London upon El Cab?" "I saw a report of it." "Your knowledge of the subject is contemptible, sir," cried the Egyptologist. "Yet it is superior to that of many who make even greater pretensions. The whole keystone of our old life in Egypt was not the inscriptions or monuments, of which you make so much, but was our hermetic philosophy and mystic knowledge, of which you say little or nothing." "Our old life?" repeated the scholar, wide-eyed. And then suddenly, "Good God, look at the mummy's face." The strange man turned, and flashed his light upon the dead woman, uttering a long doleful cry as he did so. The action of the air had already undone all the art of the embalmer. The skin had fallen away, the eyes had sunk inwards, the discolored lips had writhed away from the yellow teeth, and the brown mark upon the forehead alone showed that it was indeed the same face which had shown such youth and beauty a few short minutes before. The man flapped his hands together in grief and horror. Then, mastering himself by a strong effort, he turned his hard eyes once more upon the Englishman. "It does not matter," he said, in a shaking voice. "Tea does not really matter. I came here tonight with the fixed determination to do something. It is now done. All else is as nothing. I have found my quest. The old curse is broken. I can rejoin her. What matter about her inanimate shell so long as her spirit is awaiting me at the other side of the veil?" "These are wild words," said Van Siddert Smith. He was becoming more and more convinced that he had to do with a madman. "Time presses, and I must go," continued the other. "The moment is at hand for which I have waited this weary time. But I must show you out first. Come with me." Taking up the lamp, he turned from the disordered chamber, and led the student swiftly through the long series of the Egyptian, Assyrian, and Persian apartments. At the end of the latter he pushed open a small door let into the wall, and descended a winding stone stair. The Englishman felt the cold fresh air of the night upon his brow. There was a door opposite him which appeared to communicate with the street. To the right of this another door stood ajar, throwing a spurt of yellow light across the passage. "Come in here," said the attendant shortly. Van Siddert Smith hesitated. He had hoped that he had come to the end of his adventure. Yet his curiosity was strong within him. He could not leave the matter unsolved, so he followed his strange companion into the lighted chamber. It was a small room, such as is devoted to a concierge. A wood fire sparkled in the grate. At one side stood a truckle bed, and at the other a coarse wooden chair, with a round table in the center, which bore the remains of a meal. As the visitor's eye glanced round, he could not but remark with an ever-recurring thrill that all the small details of the room were of the most quaint design and antique workmanship. The candlesticks, the vases upon the chimney piece, the fire irons, the ornaments upon the walls, were all such as he had been wont to associate with the remote past. The gnarled, heavy-eyed man sat himself down upon the edge of the bed, and motioned his guest into the chair. "There may be design in this," he said, still speaking excellent English. "Tea may be decreed that I should leave some account behind as a warning to all rash mortals who would set their wits up against workings of nature. I leave it with you. Make such use as you will of it. I speak to you now with my feet upon the threshold of the other world. I am, as you surmised, an Egyptian, not one of the downtrodden race of slaves who now inhabit the delta of the Nile, but a survivor of that fiercer and harder people who tamed the Hebrew, drove the Ethiopian back into the southern deserts, and built those mighty works which have been the envy and the wonder of all after generations. It was in the reign of Thutmosis, 1600 years before the birth of Christ, that I first saw the light. You shrink away from me. Wait, and you will see that I am more to be pitied than to be feared. My name was Sazra. My father had been the chief priest of Osiris in the great temple of Abrus, which stood in those days upon the bubastic branch of the Nile. I was brought up in the temple, and was trained in all those mystic arts which are spoken of in your own Bible. I was an apt pupil. Before I was 16, I had learned all which the wisest priest could teach me. From that time on I studied nature's secrets for myself, and shared my knowledge with no man. Of all the questions which attracted me there were none over which I labored so long, as over those which concern themselves with the nature of life. I probed deeply into the vital principle. The aim of medicine had been to drive away disease when it appeared. It seemed to me that a method might be devised which should so fortify the body as to prevent weakness or death from ever taking hold of it. It is useless that I should recount my researches. You would scarce comprehend them if I did. They were carried out partly upon animals, partly upon slaves, and partly on myself. Suffice it that their result was to furnish me with a substance which, when injected into the blood, would endow the body with strength to resist the effects of time, of violence, or of disease. It would not indeed confer immortality, but its potency would endure for many thousands of years. I used it upon a cat, and afterwards drugged the creature with the most deadly poisons. That cat is alive in Lower Egypt at the present moment. There was nothing of mystery or magic in the matter. It was simply a chemical discovery, which may well be made again. Love of life runs high in the young. It seemed to me that I had broken away from all human care now that I had abolished pain and driven death to such a distance. With a light heart I poured the accursed stuff into my veins. Then I looked round for someone whom I could benefit. There was a young priest of Thoth, Parmes by name, who had won my goodwill by his earnest nature and his devotion to his studies. To him I whispered my secret, and at his request I injected him with my elixir. I should now, I reflected, never be without a companion of the same age as myself. After this grand discovery I relaxed my studies to some extent, but Parmes continued his with redoubled energy. Every day I could see him working with his flasks and his distiller in the temple of Thoth, but he said little to me as to the result of his labors. For my own part, I used to walk through the city and look around me with exultation as I reflected that all this was destined to pass away, and that only I should remain. The people would bow to me as they passed me, for the fame of my knowledge had gone abroad. There was war at this time, and the great king had sent down his soldiers to the eastern boundary to drive away the Hyksos. A governor, too, was sent to Abrus, that he might hold it for the king. I had heard much of the beauty of the daughter of this governor, but one day as I walked out with Parmes we met her, borne upon the shoulders of her slaves. I was struck with love as with lightning. My heart went out from me. I could have thrown myself beneath the feet of her bearers. This was my woman. Life without her was impossible. I swore by the head of Horus that she should be mine. I swore it to the priest of Thoth. He turned away from me with a brow which was as black as midnight. There is no need to tell you of our wooing. She came to love me even as I loved her. I learned that Parms had seen her before I did, and had shown her that he too loved her, but I could smile at his passion, for I knew that her heart was mine. The white plague had come upon the city and many were stricken, but I laid my hands upon the sick, and nursed them without fear or scathe. She marveled at my daring. Then I told her my secret, and begged her that she would let me use my art upon her. "Your flower shall then be unwithered, Atma," apostrophe I said. "Other things may pass away, but you and I, and our great love for each other, shall outlive the tomb of King Chefru." Apostrophe, apostrophe, but she was full of timid, maidenly objections. "Was it right?" Apostrophe, she asked. "Was it not a thwarting of the will of the gods? If the great Osiris had wished that our years should be so long, would he not himself have brought it about?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, with fond and loving words I overcame her doubts, and yet she hesitated. It was a great question, she said. She would think it over for this one night. In the morning I should know her resolution. Surely one night was not too much to ask. She wished to pray to Isis for help in her decision. With a sinking heart and a sad foreboding of evil, I left her with her tirewomen. In the morning, when the yearly sacrifice was over, I hurried to her house. A frightened slave met me upon the steps. Her mistress was ill, she said, very ill. In a frenzy, I broke my way through the attendants, and rushed through hall and corridor to my Atma's chamber. She lay upon her couch, her head high upon the pillow, with a pallid face and a glazed eye. On her forehead there blazed a single angry purple patch. I knew that hell mark of old. It was the scar of the white plague, the sign manual of death. Why should I speak of that terrible time? For months I was mad, fevered, delirious, and yet I could not die. Never did an Arab thirst after the sweet wells as I longed after death. Could poison or steel have shortened the thread of my existence, I should soon have rejoined my love in the land with the narrow portal. I tried, but it was of no avail. The accursed influence was too strong upon me. One night as I lay upon my couch, weak and weary, Parms, the priest of Thoth, came to my chamber. He stood in the circle of the lamplight, and he looked down upon me with eyes which were bright with a mad joy. "Why did you let the maiden die?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, he asked. "Why did you not strengthen her as you strengthened me?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, I was too late, apostrophe, I answered. "But I had forgot. You also loved her. You are my fellow in misfortune. Is it not terrible to think of the centuries which must pass ere we look upon her again? Fools, fools, that we were to take death to be our enemy." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Why, oh, you may say that, apostrophe," he cried with a wild laugh. "Words come well from your lips. For me they have no meaning." Apostrophe, "Mean you?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, I cried, raising myself upon my elbow. "Surely, friend, this grief has turned your brain." Apostrophe, apostrophe, his face was aflame with joy, and he writhed and shook like one who hath a devil. "Do you know whither I go?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, he asked. "Nay, apostrophe, I answered. "I cannot tell." Apostrophe, "I go to her," apostrophe, said he. "She lies embalmed in the further tomb by the double palm tree beyond the city wall." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Why do you go there?" Apostrophe, apostrophe, I asked. "Die." Apostrophe, apostrophe, he shrieked. "Die. I am not bound by earthen fetters." Apostrophe, apostrophe, "Elixir is in your blood," apostrophe, I cried. "I can defy it," apostrophe, said he. "I have found a stronger principle which will destroy it. It is working in my veins at this moment, and in an hour I shall be a dead man. I shall join her, and you shall remain behind." As I looked upon him, I could see that he spoke words of truth. The light in his eye told me that he was indeed beyond the power of the elixir. You will teach me. I cried. He answered. I implore you, by the wisdom of Thoth, by the majesty of Anubis. It is useless, he said coldly. I will find it out, I cried. You cannot, he answered. It came to me by chance. There is one ingredient which you can never get. Save that which is in the ring of Thoth, none will ever more be made. I and the ring of Thoth. I repeated. Then is the ring of Thoth? Also you shall never know, he answered. You wonder love. Who has won in the end? I leave you to your sordid earth life. My chains are broken. I must go. He turned upon his heel and fled from the chamber. In the morning, came the news that the priest of Thoth was dead. My days after that were spent in study. I must find this subtle poison which was strong enough to undo the elixir. From early dawn to midnight I bent over the test tube and the furnace. Above all, I collected the papyri and the chemical flasks of the priest of Thoth. Alas! They taught me little. Here and there some hint or stray expression would raise hope in my bosom, but no good ever came of it. Still, month after month, I struggled on. When my heart grew faint I would make my way to the tomb by the palm trees. There, standing by the dead casket from which the jewel had been rifled, I would feel her sweet presence, and would whisper to her that I would rejoin her if mortal wit could solve the riddle. Parms had said that his discovery was connected with the ring of Thoth. I had some remembrance of the trinket. It was a large and weighty circlet, made, not of gold, but of a rarer and heavier metal brought from the mines of Mount Harbal. Platinum, you call it. The ring had, I remembered, a hollow crystal set in it, in which some few drops of liquid might be stored. Now, the secret of Parms could not have to do with the metal alone, for there were many rings of that metal in the temple. Was it not more likely that he had stored his precious poison within the cavity of the crystal? I had scarce come to this conclusion before, in hunting through his papers, I came upon one which told me that it was indeed so, and that there was still some of the liquid unused. But how to find the ring? It was not upon him when he was stripped for the embalmer. Of that I made sure. Neither was it among his private effects. In vain I searched every room that he had entered, every box, and vase, and chattel that he had owned. I sifted the very sand of the desert in the places where he had been wont to walk, but, do what I would, I could come upon no traces of the ring of Thoth. Yet it may be that my labors would have overcome all obstacles had it not been for a new and unlooked for misfortune. A great war had been waged against the Hyksos, and the captains of the great king had been cut off in the desert, with all their bowmen and horsemen. The shepherd tribes were upon us like the locusts in a dry year. From the wilderness of Shur to the great bitter lake there was blood by day and fire by night. Abrus was the bulwark of Egypt, but we could not keep the savages back. The city fell. The governor and the soldiers were put to the sword, and I, with many more, was led away into captivity. For years and years I tended cattle in the great plains by the Euphrates. My master died, and his son grew old, but I was still as far from death as ever. At last I escaped upon a swift camel, and made my way back to Egypt. The Hyksos had settled in the land which they had conquered, and their own king ruled over the country. Abrus had been torn down, the city had been burned, and of the great temple there was nothing left save an unsightly mound. Everywhere the tombs had been rifled, and the monuments destroyed. Of my Atma's grave no sign was left. It was buried in the sands of the desert, and the palm trees which marked the spot had long disappeared. The papers of Parmes and the remains of the Temple of Thoth were either destroyed, or scattered far and wide over the deserts of Syria. All search after them was vain. From that time I gave up all hope of ever finding the ring or discovering the subtle drug. I set myself to live as patiently as might be until the effect of the elixir should wear away. How can you understand how terrible a thing time is, you who have experience only of the narrow course which lies between the cradle and the grave? I know it to my cost, I who have floated down the whole stream of history. I was old when Ilium fell. I was very old when Herodotus came to Memphis. I was bowed down with years when the new gospel came upon earth. Yet you see me much as other men are, with the cursed elixir still sweetening my blood, and guarding me against that which I would court. Now at last I have come to the end of it. I have traveled in all lands and I have dwelt with all nations. Every tongue is the same to me. I learned them all to help pass the weary time. I need not tell you how slowly they drifted by, the long dawn of modern civilization, the dreary middle years, the dark times of barbarism. They are all behind me now. I have never looked with the eyes of love upon another woman. Atma knows that I have been constant to her. It was my custom to read all that the scholars had to say upon ancient Egypt. I have been in many positions, sometimes affluent, sometimes poor, but I have always found enough to enable me to buy the journals which deal with such matters. Some 9 months ago I was in San Francisco, when I read an account of some discoveries made in the neighborhood of Abrus. My heart leapt into my mouth as I read it. It said that the excavator had busied himself in exploring some tombs recently unearthed. In one there had been found an unopened mummy with an inscription upon the outer case setting forth that it contained the body of the daughter of the governor of the city in the days of Thutmosis. It added that on removing the outer case there had been exposed a large platinum ring set with a crystal, which had been laid upon the breast of the embalmed woman. This, then, was where Parmes had hid the ring of Thoth. He might well say that it was safe, for no Egyptian would ever stain his soul by moving even the outer case of a buried friend. That very night I set off from San Francisco, and in a few weeks I found myself once more at Abrus, if a few sand heaps and crumbling walls may retain the name of the great city. I hurried to the Frenchmen who were digging there, and asked them for the ring. They replied that both the ring and the mummy had been sent to the Boulak Museum at Cairo. To Boulak I went, but only to be told that Mariette Bey had claimed them, and had shipped them to the Louvre. I followed them, and there at last, in the Egyptian chamber, I came, after close upon 4,000 years, upon the remains of my Atma, and upon the ring for which I had sought so longitude. But how was I to lay hands upon them? How was I to have them for my very own? It chanced that the office of attendant was vacant. I went to the director. I convinced him that I knew much about Egypt. In my eagerness I said too much. He remarked that a professor's chair would suit me better than a seat in the conciergerie. I knew more, he said, than he did. It was only by blundering and letting him think that he had overestimated my knowledge that I prevailed upon him to let me move the few effects which I have retained into this chamber. It is my first and my last night here. Such is my story, Mr. Van Siddert Smith. I need not say more to a man of your perception. By a strange chance you have this night looked upon the face of the woman whom I loved in those far-off days. There were many rings with crystals in the case, and I had to test for the platinum, to be sure of the one which I wanted. A glance at the crystal has shown me that the liquid is indeed within it, and that I shall at last be able to shake off that accursed health which has been worse to me than the foulest disease. I have nothing more to say to you. I have unburdened myself. You may tell my story or you may withhold it at your pleasure. The choice rests with you. I owe you some amends, for you have had a narrow escape of your life this night. I was a desperate man, and not to be balked in my purpose. Had I seen you before the thing was done, I might have put it beyond your power to oppose me, or to raise an alarm. This is the door. It leads into the Rue de Rivoli. Good night. The Englishman glanced back. For a moment the lean figure of Sazra the Egyptian stood framed in the narrow doorway. The next the door had slammed, and the heavy rasping of a bolt broke on the silent night. It was on the second day after his return to London that Mr. John Van Siddert Smith saw the following concise narrative in the Paris correspondence of the Times. Curious occurrence in the Louvre. Yesterday morning a strange discovery was made in the principal Egyptian chamber. The ouvriers who are employed to clean out the rooms in the morning found one of the attendants lying dead upon the floor with his arms round one of the mummies. So close was his embrace, that it was only with the utmost difficulty that they were separated. One of the cases containing valuable rings had been opened and rifled. The authorities are of opinion that the man was bearing away the mummy with some idea of selling it to a private collector, but that he was struck down in the very act by long-standing disease of the heart. It is said that he was a man of uncertain age and eccentric habits, without any living relations, to mourn over his dramatic and untimely end. End of the Project Gutenberg e-text of the Captain of the Polestar. Post Sir Arthur Conan Doyle by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, Gutenberg edition.